I was, this is kind of, you know, in violation of standard good communication practice here, but the story that I wanted to start with is heavy. I was listening a few weeks ago to a broadcast, and the broadcast was exploring the hypersexualized nature of our culture, and in particular of our youth culture, and how that thread in the fabric of our society is being woven tightly around those that are younger and younger. And one of the folks that was part of this broadcast is a school counselor, researcher into all of this. And she told a story about 2 8-year-old girls in Ontario recently that took a cell phone picture of themselves topless at a pajama party and sent it to some boys in their class. And when somebody asked these folks, these kids, why did you do that? The girls said, because we wanted them to notice us. My daughter, Taya, just turned 8. Taya is a beautiful child of 8. When I heard this story, I just about had to pull off the road to weep. Ah, man. This is a story about a lot of things. It's about, as the structure of the broadcast suggested, the increasingly young age at which the culture in which we live is making explicit the hypersexual. I don't think taking compromising photographs of yourself and sending them to people electronically is a good idea for anyone. It's tragic in a child and stupid in an adult. But it's a little more comprehensible, at least, in the adult world. But we're making these things explicit at younger and younger ages in our culture. And that's partly what the story's about. Partly the story's about the impact of freely and privately available pornography to all of us, the impact of that on the culture, because this is a subset of that story. It's a story that's also about the implicit understanding that these children already carry, however they come to carry it, that there is a profound relationship between sex and power, and that that's a relationship that can easily be used in broken and destructive ways. It's also a story, maybe more broadly, about our innate drive to be noticed. Whatever our motives might be, we seem to understand that doing something spectacular will get us noticed. And that getting noticed just might move us toward getting whatever it is that we think we want. All of this feeds, at least for me, as I've been thinking about the biblical story we've been exploring, it feeds in an intriguing way into the nature of the second of the three temptations of Christ. Short review, because among other things we have lots of guests this morning. We've been exploring in the season of Lent the story of Jesus' temptation in the wilderness. It is the story that gives Lent its shape. It gives it the shape of 40 days. It gives it the shape that has to do with fasting, with attending honestly to the shape of our own souls and lives, and confessing the things that we find there that are not all that they ought to be. It gives us the shape of taking what might feel to us like a really long on-ramp to the resurrection celebration of Easter morning. And last week we considered the temptation that is offered to Christ to be relevant, which we chose to understand as thinking and living as though we are what we make or produce. And that when it comes to pleasing God or to making an impact on the world in behalf of God, if we can say it that way, the temptation is to believe that we need to define ourselves by what we do produce or make happen. And we contrasted that with Jesus' response, which pointed to the importance of opening the hungers, the longings in our lives, for God to fill, and then from that place of open longing, of open hunger, offering whatever unique gift we have and are to the world around us, and that was an important prioritization exercise, among other things, working at getting those things in that order. This week, what I want to do a little bit in this part of our gathering is explore the second temptation of Christ, which is, we've been taking the sequence of these from the Gospel of Matthew. And in that Gospel, this is the text that outlines the story of the second temptation. Then the devil took Jesus to the holy city and had him stand on the highest point of the temple. "If you are the Son of God," he said, "throw yourself down. For it is written, he will command his angels concerning you, and they will lift you up in their hands so that you will not strike your foot against a stone." Jesus answered him, "It is also written, do not put the Lord your God to the test." Dialogue in the story is fairly pithy. Not a lot of elaboration. You ever notice how when an action-oriented movie is being marketed, it's generally considered some kind of an accolade when an actor does their own stunts? Like, we all get the economics of it, right? You paid them how much and you let them jump off what? Maybe the accolade is to the executive producer, not the actor. But anyway, it's kind of what's going on in this story to some degree. Because what happens in the story, to put it another way, is that the tempter comes to Jesus and he says, "You want to have an impact? No pun intended. Do something spectacular. Throw yourself down from the highest point in the city. Because what's going to happen, because God said it would happen, is that the angels are going to catch you in midair. And they're going to set you down right in the middle of the city. Unharmed. The crowd is going to love it. And that will get an audience for God." It's kind of a combination of, if you're really awesome, you should do your own stunts, and this blurry line between spectacular and spectacle that I've found epitomized this past little while by wardrobe selections for the Oscars. If you followed that whole sentence, there was some humor in there, but it was a long way of getting to it. Interesting thing, though, about Jesus' response to the temptation is he makes it very clear that whatever else he's here to do, he didn't come to prove himself by doing his own stunts. It's just not part of the plan. He's not here to walk on hot coals or to juggle live snakes or to stick his hand into a lion's mouth and pull it out unharmed to demonstrate somehow that he's got something to say, that he's credible, that he should be noticed. And it's interesting, it's kind of, you have to spend some time with the story, I think, but I think it is consistent with the story that Jesus' response to this also makes it clear that he's not here to be some kind of superhero. He's not here to be somebody that can do it all and do it alone. And if those thoughts have merit, if that's not what he's here for, as we find it in this story, then what is he here for? I want us to think back to last week's exploration just for a minute. Because the temptation we talked about there was a temptation of Jesus to be relevant, give the people what they want. And here's the question that comes for me. If being relevant is not the core of the way of Jesus, then is the way of Jesus the opposite? Or is that an interesting starting place? Because the opposite would be to be irrelevant. And if there's something to that idea that's worth exploring, then in a culture that has a tendency to affirm us for what we make or cause to happen, and that offers us considerable kind of confidence-building affirmation when we play the game by those rules, do the thing that needs done, do it fantastically well, and we'll not only applaud, but we'll give you more money. And just because of our human experience of affirmation and its real value, we tend to build confidence out of that. If we don't play the game that way, if we don't go looking as followers of Jesus for our sense of strong ability to face the challenges of life by building them up in that manner, then how do we do that? If that's not the path, what is the path? There's this great story in the Gospels about Jesus turning Peter from a fisherman into a shepherd. It's in John chapter 21, right at the end of the Gospel of John. And Peter's transformation in the biblical story is so profound. The way our sacred text unfolds his tale is staggering. It is one of the great sort of spiritual makeover stories of the Bible. But for me, at least, that story often doesn't have the shape that I expect it to have. This is an interesting aspect of that story. Jesus is talking to Peter, and he's about ready to send Peter into the prevailing culture to launch what will become what we know as Christendom. And he has a really significant conversation with him on the eve of that launch. And in that conversation, Jesus asks Peter the same question three times. Peter, do you love me? Do you love me? Do you really love me? And we have to remember, if we're going to get out of this story, I think what we can, we have to remember who Jesus is in terms of his experience as fully God and fully human at this point in the story. Because who Jesus is at this point in the conversation is someone who has been, for all intents and purposes, cast aside. This is a guy who has given his entire life to proclaiming the message that God is love and that love is for everyone. And the world has not only not paid attention to him and to his message, to what he's offering, but they have aggressively rejected it. And in a world that is in search of power and efficiency and control, Jesus has offered none of those things. And he has been put aside. Crucifixion, it would be fair to say, is an aggressive rejection. But here Jesus is, appearing in this story in what the Bible calls his glorified body, wounds and all, to a few friends that seem to still have eyes to see and ears to hear and hearts to believe. And when he shows up for these people, this little nucleus of people that still seem open to him and his message, the question that the rejected, unknown, wounded Jesus has to ask is simply, do you love me? I don't know if we can get how significant that question is coming as it does from Jesus in this story. I think it's worth noting what he doesn't ask, this nucleus of people, as well. He doesn't ask how many people have been taking them and their message seriously. He doesn't ask what kind of results they're getting. He doesn't ask if they have yet figured out the matrix for measuring what good the things they're doing or causing to be done might be bringing to the world around them. He doesn't ask, what spectacular demonstration can you make to prove that you are cherished by God and subsequently worth paying attention to? What he asks is, do you love me? And maybe, in answer to the question, if Jesus wasn't here to be relevant, then what was he here for? And by extension, if following Jesus isn't a call for us to be relevant, then what is it a call for? It seems like maybe the answer is something along the lines of to find our own way together to answering the question, do you love me? With a wholehearted yes. And not just a wholehearted yes, because in our Western inclination to chop ourselves up into tidy boxes, we need to find our way deeper into a whole life yes. There is a staggering need. You guys, maybe you run into it every day in your life experience. I do. There is a staggering need in this world for men and women who know the heart of God who know what it is like to be close to a heart that forgives and that cares and that reaches out and that wants to heal. What it's like to walk through life close to a heart that just has no suspicion in it, that has no vindictiveness in it, that has no resentment in it, that doesn't have a whiff of hatred in it. There is a heart, mind, gut, life-wrenching need for people in this world who know what it's like to be close to a heart that only wants to give love and to receive love in response. If God is love, as God's self defines, God's self in the Christian scriptures, if God is love and only love, then every time that fear and isolation and despair invade the human soul or the human life, those are not things that come from God. And so help me, they do not become things that come from God when they happen in the name of religion. They remain not things that come from God. I keep having conversations, and I know I have a privileged life in this regard, and I don't take it for granted. But as a pastor, I keep having meaningful conversations with people. I love my life. And part of what is challenging about so many of those conversations, and again, this past week, I can name four just off the top of my head. Conversations with people that if you meet them in the street, shook their hand, got to know them, you go, what? You are a lovely, well-adjusted human being, whatever our paradigm is for health, you know? And I'm not saying that what I'm about to say negates that, but when you get underneath the kind of together exterior of the story, there is agony. And over again, the agony has to do, one way or another, with not knowing deeply what it is like to be loved and to be confident that we are loved. Their family stories, their marriage stories, their work stories, their heartbreaking stories. When we face life not knowing that we're loved, we will do almost anything to have an experience that feels like what we imagine being loved would feel like. And it seems for many of us that that means constantly trying to do something spectacular to get noticed. And it seems often in our lives that if we can't be spectacular, we'll settle for being a spectacle. We might come up with tidy psych language for it. Oh, look, they're acting out. I'm not denigrating that language. Sometimes it's very helpful. But in the end, even if we didn't have it, we'd come back to something like this. Would somebody please notice me in a way that gives me a deep confidence that I am loved? And I'm going to argue, and you can take me to task if you wish. If you do, I'll know you were listening. And that'll feel nice. I'm going to suggest that when Jesus asks Peter, "Do you love me?" he's in the same kind of fully God, fully human space that we find it uncomfortable to acknowledge, but he's in the same kind of fully human, fully God space that he's in the garden when he's saying to God the Father, "If there's a way around this, I'd like to know about it now." And the same kind of space that he's in when he seems to not know who his betrayer is and know who his betrayer is at the same time. And in the same kind of space that he's in when he's on the cross, and he says, my God, why have you forsaken me? And then thinks better of it, or finds his way back to the truth moments later, and commits his hands into the his life into the hands of a Father that he knows has never abandoned him. Whatever it felt like. I think that this longing, this uncertainty about being loved is as human as drawing breath. And I think that working our way toward a place in our life where this center that this is begins to become a confident, solid, dependable place does more than any other thing I could think of to free us to live well in the world, to carry what is good and right and lovely into the world. Maybe almost our whole reason for being is to get to know God so deeply and so intimately and so lovingly that we gradually become people that know that we are loved and that we are loved in a way that can't be taken from us by the partial shadowy reflections of limited human love. Nor by human evil or hatred, nor by any circumstance or challenge that we might face. Maybe when we can say with Peter, Lord, you know that I love you, we can begin to get a hint of what the most important thing that we can offer the world is. And we get a little hint about why Jesus answered the tempter the way that he did. See, when Jesus hears Peter's confession of love for him, and don't forget, Peter's the guy who let Jesus down rather egregiously not very long before. And Jesus knows that. When Jesus hears Peter's confession of love for him, he moves on to the next part of the story. And the way that John tells the story, you can almost, to me this is a movie moment, just, I mean, we grew up with the screen, right? But one of the things that an actor gets paid a lot for these days is for a face that can communicate a lot, because the filmmaker knows that we're going to see that face probably at some point pretty big. In fact, now we're going to see it at home, about the same size we used to see it in the theater I grew up with, in a town of 2,000 people. We're going to see it big. We're going to see it bigger than life, and we're going to catch the nuance of the tick by the eye and the little twitch by the corner of the mouth and the eyes moving off the camera and back and all those things that a good face actor does to communicate volumes. And the filmmaker knows that, and they want an actor that can convey that. And so in my imagination, when I read this moment between Jesus and Peter where Jesus says to Peter, Peter, do you love me? Do you really love me? Do you love me more than all of these? And Peter says, yes, Lord, you know that I love you. I hear and see a pause. And what flits across Jesus' face is a consideration of the plausibility of Peter's answer. Do I move forward now? Or is the question still outstanding? Does he mean it? And if he does mean it, what does that mean? What am I going to do with this? And something in my imagination's eye settles in Jesus' face. And he moves on to the next part of the story and he says to Peter, feed my sheep. Now, pastoral sheep herding language aside, because most of us don't live there, this is not a very hard picture to understand, really, is it? It's Jesus saying to Peter, if you love me, love those that I love, and show them love the way that I show you love. That's all bound up in feed my sheep, you know? We can call it passing it on, we can call it paying it forward, we can call it random acts of kindness, we can call it what would Jesus do, we can call it apprenticing ourselves to Christ. We can keep going with the list. This is the central response to the insanity of thinking that being a spectacular solo disciple of Jesus is what God is asking us for. It is not what God is asking us for. What am I thinking as a speaker when I say things like that? I know what God is asking us for. Right. These are all qualified. By my limited knowing. I think the people that are regularly part of the community are advised of that. If you're a guest, I just want you to know. my belief when I spend time with this story is that what God is asking of us is what Jesus was asking of those that called themselves his friends. That we love him, and that as that love grows in us, we do not keep it to ourselves, but we share it with the people around us. I think that's the center of the story. I think it's the center of Jesus' response. Why don't we do this? Why don't we do it more? Why don't we do it better, if you want? I think there's a connection between that answer to that question and this temptation. The temptation, the sort of the first two temptations combined, really, this temptation to be competent and please God that way, or to do something spectacular and please God that way. Could it be that we don't wade in where love is needed because we still think somewhere deep in our soul that what God really wants from us, first and foremost, is to be competent and spectacularly so? I didn't say anything to them in their grief because I didn't know what to say. I'm not saying we knew what to say. I'm saying that's a competency question. That's a competency response. I hear you if you've ever made that response. You have all my empathy. I get that. I live there. Still, this is the temptation, right? I'm not going in there because I'm not competent. Again, Jesus doesn't denigrate competence. He doesn't say you should live without bread. He just says not this first and not this alone. Maybe we're reluctant because we still haven't answered the temptation. The belief that what God wants most from us is competence. I'm going to fail if I do this. If I try to do this thing that my heart is saying love needs to do here, I am just going to blow up. I am not going to perform in a spectacular manner if I wade into this one. What if that's not what God's asking for? What if that's not the nugget at all? What if that's the temptation? Believe that. What if what we are most significantly called to do is to learn to know the heart of God so deeply that we actually start to live like we are loved? And then realizing that it's impossible to live like you're loved and keep it to yourself, we start to share it with others. What if? And what if taking a few deliberate steps, not complicated ones, simple ones, ones we learned in Lent, of all places, what if taking a few deliberate steps could carry us deeper and deeper into the confidence that we are loved? What kind of direction would that carry us beyond that experience? What if something as accessible, something as simple, if you will, as giving up a regular habit or luxury or taking on a particular practice for just more than a month of our life, what if something that concrete could be the doorway to the kind of being with Jesus that begins to have the truth that we are deeply, irrevocably, inescapably loved start to settle into our lives and spill over into the lives of others? What if? What if paying attention to the true shape of our souls in confession, in sharing of who we truly are in the presence of God and appropriately in the presence of others, what if that could begin to give us confidence in the face of the challenges that life brings such that we no longer step back from loving others because we don't feel like our expression of that love would be competent or spectacular? What if? What if the world is full of people that need, even as Jesus needed, to hear a clear answer to the question, do you love me? And what if we are here to be part of the way that God answers that question?